But first, I want to look at matters arising from a culture 10 times as ancient. I referred, of course, to the culture of the First Nations. In the midst of all the chaos being caused by COVID and the US election, which, of course, is a related issue, we're trying here at LNL to keep you updated on some of the stories that aren't getting the discussion they deserve. And tonight we're going to chat about some of the issues currently facing the Indigenous communities around Australia. To fill us in, I'm pleased to welcome Jack Lattimore to the program. Jack is a Burpai Dungari man. He is the NITV News Digital Editor. He also co-hosts and produces the podcast series Take It Black and writes for numerous other publications, including The Guardian and the recent issue of Meanjin. I commend that to you. It's a fine piece. Jack, welcome.
Thanks, Philip. How are you?
All the better for hearing your voice. Now, let's begin. We could begin all over the place, but let's begin with the protest at Origin Energy's AGM. Tell me about that.
Well, you're right. We could start all over the place. This one's a pretty new story. We ran with it today. Some traditional owners up there in the Beetaloo Basin area, Alawa and Mudborough Jingli traditional owners, some of them native title holders, they infiltrated Origin Energy's AGM meeting today. And they had some questions that they put to Origin Energy Chair Gordon Cairns. They say that they left that AGM feeling angry and upset. Mr. Cairns claimed that they weren't the traditional owners that were affected by some of the mining activities that were taking place on a permit in the northern part of the Beetaloo Basin or the Beetaloo area. Mr. Cairns said he was confident that Origin's consultation with the traditional owners, because he had sat down and had dinner with them. Now, one of those traditional owners was Auntie Naomi Wilfred, and she said he never sat down with her. She said, "I don't know him from a bar of soap."
Heavens above, we should point out to the listener that Beetaloo Basin's about, 500 k's southeast of Darwin on the Sturt Plateau, and we're talking about fracking planned for the basin. I understand that fracking has begun after a 3-year moratorium.
Yeah, there was a moratorium, and then there was a long period of big wet up there that held them up. And then there was concerns that they were going to start prior to the wet, or just around the period when there was still water travelling across country. And, of course, there were concerns that that would, contaminate drinking supply and other areas of sensitivity, environmental sensitivity up there. So it looks like that, they're going to go ahead, particularly after the large allocation of money in the budget, the recent 2020 budget.
And you're not buying the argument that Cairns mounts that there's absolutely no threat, no danger, everything will be fine.
Well, I can only go off what the traditional owners of the country up there are saying, and they have genuine concerns. So they put a few questions and basically didn't feel that they were answered very well, and left just saying they didn't want a gas pipeline running through their country. Damaged sacred sites, and they asked, when were you going to stop this destruction and leave our lands?
Are there significant sites there?
Well, they would be, yeah. I'm not from up in that country, so I wouldn't know too much about that, and I wouldn't dare speak for them. But, yeah, there'd definitely be sites of sensitivity around there that would be impacted by fracking and, the sorts of things that we see as a byproduct of fracking.
Well, we're going to circle back to sacred sites in just a moment, but, of course, Origin are promising huge numbers of jobs, are they not?
There are jobs that have been offered or have been mentioned for Aboriginal people, but again, the leaders of those communities, the traditional owners and elders amongst those traditional owner group, they're saying that the community's focus or main concern is on country.
Jack, of course, this the timing at the moment is that the federal government is pushing the whole idea of fracking and gas at the highest level.
Yeah, they seem to be, Philip. That's right. I mean, we had, I think it was $53 million that was allocated to accelerating gas projects as part of the budget, some fuel tax credits, some tax cuts, and a little bit of flexibility added around investing up north in the Northern Territory. So, yeah, there's a bit of incentive to get things cracking. And, of course, we've seen some stuff on the East Coast as well. Out at Narrabri, was it? There's a large facility being established out there as well. So,
I mentioned at the beginning of the program that after you and I have talked, we're off to ancient Egypt. But ancient Egypt, or the Egypt we'll be looking at, dates back 5,000 years, I guess. We're now talking about something that dates back 46,000 years, and I'm talking about the caves in Juukan Gorge.
Yeah, deep time. It's kind of difficult to get your head around that depth of time, I suppose. But, those two sites in Juukan Gorge were destroyed by Rio Tinto. I'm sure most listeners would be across that. And there's been a committee, a joint standing committee, that are looking into the circumstances that led to their destruction.
I'd forgotten that this event occurred on Sorry Day, for heaven's sake. Marcia Langton described it as perhaps the oldest site of continuous human occupation in the world. What an atrocity.
It was an absolute atrocity, and the evidence that the inquiry, so the committee heard, seemed to suggest that it was they were aware of its significance, that a lot of these artifacts have been, a shipping container of artifacts have been removed from the cave site before it was blasted. So it wasn't the oversight that the narrative put forward in the first instance seemed to suggest. There's a little bit more to it. And as the committee sat, I think it started in early August, the public hearing, was frustrated by COVID, quarantine, not being able to access. They moved to video conferencing. At one stage, the committee itself wanted to go up on country to see for themselves the destruction. That hasn't happened yet. That's where we're up to with the committee. I think they're looking to do that next month as, borders ease and all that sort of caper.
Chris Salisbury has stepped down over the issue. He's the CEO of Rio Tinto. But I'd learned from you that the woman from Rio, responsible for heritage issues, had never visited the caves because the area wasn't on her heritage list.
Yeah, that's right. There's a number of people that were making decisions and calls that hadn't visited the area, that didn't know of the area. People on the ground did. And as I said, some artifacts were stored in a shipping container. There was a number of archaeological digs and that sort of, recording that occurred around the caves. There was also a video that came to light recorded by KKP traditional owners. Came to light during the course of this inquiry. And they were expressing their concerns around access to the area where the two sites were located back in 2015, 2016. They were asking Rio Tinto to get in there and facing hurdles to do so. So
now, if it blew the cave to smithereens, it's also blown trust between Indigenous Australians and the mining companies.
Well, that's right. Again, through the inquiry, we heard traditional owner groups, not only the PKK, PKKP, but Eastern Garuma traditional owners. They said that they've had, experienced some difficulties with other mining giants. Fortescue Metals Group was the one mentioned. They said, well, Fortescue Metals Group, there was a moratorium placed on the area where the Juukan Gorge caves were destroyed. There are other sites in that area. Rio Tinto had established a moratorium on mining activity. Fortescue Metals Group were asked to observe that moratorium by their shareholders, both they and BHP Billiton shareholders, and they weren't real big on that. They decided they weren't going to do it. They said that it would... it would hold them up too much. So it emerged during this inquiry that this Eastern Garuma traditional owners group said that Fortescue Metals had been withholding royalties that were owed to them if they refused to sign off on new mining leases. This has all happened since September 26.
Jack, perhaps Twiggy will be able to explain himself when he delivers the Boyer lectures. And you've been looking at the other end of the mining process, haven't you, when the miners close the mine and leave town.
Yeah, that's right. We published a story on the weekend, actually, around Jabiru, the site perhaps notoriously known for the Ranger uranium mine, long-running mining protest demonstrations and camps up around Jabiru as well. It is looking, well, the parent company that operates that uranium mine is Rio Tinto, and they're looking to wind down mining operations on the site in January next year. Now, what that brings with it is a lot of local businesses shutting their doors, and the community, the Jabiru community, were concerned. They needed to change tact. They're looking at creating a tourist hub up there. Pretty good spot.
Well, we should remind people that it's adjacent to Kakadu, isn't it?
Surrounded by the national park, yeah. So nice spot. And the bakery closed recently, but what the traditional owners up there, they occupied the space and have created themselves a new, they're calling it the Murrawaddy Art Centre. And it's providing a space for local artists to not only exhibit their work, but, you know, a workspace for them, a studio space for them. A bit closer than the old one, which was a gallery that was based at the old hub, the old tourist hub in Kakadu. It was a fair bit of a walk out of Jabiru. So, yeah, they're saying that the artists are happy. They're getting a few tourists in. Everyone seems to be pretty happy with that and the direction that the town's going now that the mining operations are winding down.
Jack, would you be kind enough to explain to me what's going on with the Aboriginal flag?
Well, fairly recently, there was a committee established, Senate committee, to look into licensing arrangements and copyright for the flag. Harold Thomas, paired up with a company that is a non-Indigenous company named Wham Clothing, and they've issued copyright breach notices to any company that was using the flag on merchandising, that sort of thing. So the Senate committee was established after 12 months or more, probably, of small groups, small businesses being issued with these sorts of breach notices. They came together. It was chaired by Melandiri McCarthy. A number of people put forward submissions. What they decided in the end were a few recommendations, and that was that the government does not compulsorily acquire the copyright of the flag, that remain with Harold Thomas. They also recommended that an independent body be established that would decide on the use of the flag. But, yeah, I mean, what we've seen in that period of 12 12 to 18 months is Aboriginal people kind of moving away from the use of the flag in some respects, and a number of First Nations designing their own flags.
What's happening with the Uluru Statement, Jack? We had Thomas Mayer on the program earlier in the year trying to build momentum and pressure on the government to act, but once again, COVID has given the government a hiding place.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is huge. We could talk about this for 5 hours or more. Where it's at the moment is that Ken Wyatt or the government's advisory groups have met for the last time, and they're finalising an interim report that they will submit to the federal government around co-designing what a voice may look like. And that is a voice to government that is different to what the Uluru statement was putting forward, and that was a voice, a constitutionally enshrined voice, plus truth-telling, plus a Makarrata. Now, the Greens have come in recently. They've stepped back from their support for the Uluru Statement, and they're pushing for a treaty, a federal treaty now. That seemed to have come at the same time as Lydia Thorpe became the senator, replaced the other guy whose name I've forgotten as I'm trying to get through this Conrec story. So, yeah, it kind of echoes what happened down here in Victoria around the state-based treaty, where the Greens took on a position advocating for a treaty in the first place, and then there were issues around elements of the treaty with the Labor government's different actions on putting highways through cultural sensitive landscapes and some logging practices. So Lydia stepped up into the federal Greens, Lydia Thorpe, and they look now that they're pushing or advocating for this federal treaty. Now, there's a whole range of positions on this, and we're going to publish something that is a bit of an explainer. We have, that's one position. The Uluru Statement is another position. The Ken Wyatt's advisory groups and the voice to government is a third position. Yeah. Michael Mansell was pushing for dedicated seats. Noel Pearson at one stage was advocating for some dedicated seats as well. Pat Turner, who is part of the advisory groups of Ken Wyatt, recently at her national press conference stepped aside from that and said that it had the potential to fail Aboriginal people. There's a lot of scrambling for grassroots support. Everyone claims that they've got it, and
well, Jack, why would we should we expect Aboriginal politics to be monolithic when whitefella politics most certainly isn't? Incidentally, as you know, I'm a nocturnal broadcaster, but I understand that NITV is going to run a first all-Indigenous breakfast show during NAIDOC.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's been a long time coming. There's a huge appetite for it out there, so we're running 5 days of an all-Indigenous breakfast show that will feature all sorts of things. That you
I
see
understand you're doing a cooking spot.
They wouldn't give me the cooking spot, Philip. I only wanted to eat pippies for breakfast, and they gave me the boot. That's gone to somebody else. I'm locked out in Melbourne as well, so I think they wanted someone in Sydney to be present in the studio rather than cooking via video conference.
I mentioned your Mianjin piece at the beginning of the program, which is about being locked down. I got to know your dog a bit. His name is Villain, is that right?
His name's Smitty, but he is a villain, that's for sure.
Okay. So Villain's a pseudonym.
He's a pseudonym, but he lives up to it. That's we're all wearing masks down here, that's his mask.
It's a great piece in which you, among other things, you ponder the life of Archie Roach and also Sidney Nolan, who lived in your area.
Yeah, that's right. Well, they both lived in my area, and I was walking past a lot of these sites when I walked the Villain. I got commissioned by Rolling Stone magazine, the Australian version, to write a piece for Archie Roach, 30th anniversary of Charcoal Lane. They published something 30 years ago written by one Michael Langslow. So in my research, I looked him up and spotted something that was connected to the Sidney Nolan Trust, followed that thread, and it turned out that Michael Langslow was Sidney Nolan's grandson. He had been influenced in and informed, I suppose, around Aboriginal politics, Aboriginal affairs, through some paintings that Sidney Nolan did as an older fella, spray can paintings. And they were looking at the death of John Pat over there in WA. And of course, John Pat was one of the early sort of Aboriginal deaths in custody that prompted the commencement of the Aboriginal, the Royal Commission into Aboriginal Deaths in Custody. It was a huge sort of cyclical, interrelated, intersectional set of coincidences, very surreal, very much in the aesthetic of a Sidney Nolan painting, actually. So I decided to write something that resembled a Sidney Nolan painting, but with the lyricism of Archie Roach's songbook.
Look, I'd like to offer you a cooking spot on Late Night Live. Would you?
I'll take it.
Would you? Look,
I need a gig.
Jack, thanks for coming on. You and I should do this more often.
Oh, I'd love to, Phil.
Would you be up for that?
I'm a nocturnal beast as well, so I'm definitely keen for that.
The voice of Jack Lattimore, writer and NITV News digital editor, and now our official chef here at Late Night Live. And as promised, from one ancient culture to a much more recent one, ancient Egypt. ¶¶